Probably. It does it on channel 25. I think it occasionally does it on channel 50, where the 25-1-2-3 get mixed up, or the 50-1 and 50-3 get mixed up. And I do a little bit of reprogramming of that channel. Turn it off, so to speak, turn it back on, program something alongside of it, make some kind of a change in that vicinity of the memory, so to speak, and sometimes it comes back to the way it should be. Sometimes also when you turn it completely off and turn it back on, there's some kind of a boot program that will occasionally correct that. But I've had that exact same thing happen with my Radio Shack digital top box. Also, my remote control for that. By the way, that Radio Shack digital converter, I'm positive it's a discontinued product. If I wanted to buy another one, I think it's impossible. My remote control, some of the buttons have turned into very difficult operation. You got to press them real hard and hold, and you got to find alternate ways of getting to that button. I'd love to be able to buy another remote control for that. Yes, I'm living in the dark ages. 2 years ago, I should have gone out and bought a real modern-day digital television. I'm still using an analog television with a digital converter box. That's what I think you're doing, Paul. So I'm living in the dark ages. It's time for me to update. But for the...
It'll look very well.
What was that again, John? Everything will look... What was that?
You have to send everything to La Brea.
Okay. So, if I wanted to buy another remote control for that, I've done various searches for it, and I'm almost positive it doesn't exist. And anybody who's had that box in the past probably threw it out and threw out the remote control, and theirs may have been in better shape than mine. Mine's had a lot of use. So, I wonder if you've heard of stories like this, Eric, and is it a thing that happens even on modern digital television set, or is it only on the converter boxes? And do you know of any other great way of solving it? KE2EJ, if you're there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Head to APG on the comment.
There's a man with either a tone or a feedback. I'm not sure which that was. Very good. My goodness. Dave, you've also got a set-top box, I believe. So I wonder if yours has done any of those tricks on you and what you've done to solve it. And to APG, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, I just wanted to check with Paul, clarify his situation. He mentioned something about, he was expecting a particular program, and then it was in Spanish. Because my converter box and the remote control has one of the buttons on the remote control, I think it's abbreviated SAP, Sugar Alpha Papa, and that has to do with the audible language. So if you're watching 60 Minutes, and you want to see it in Spanish, you can press that button and you get 60 minutes in Spanish. So I wonder if that's what he's referring to or something else.
I have it. Yeah, I've also done that. SAP is Second Audio Program. And yes, you can make the audio on the program you're watching turn into Spanish in some cases. That's not what I think Paul is describing to us. I think Paul, under ordinary conditions, 13-3 is a Spanish-speaking channel. And he was tuned to 13-1. He wanted to watch this program on hot air balloons with Ben Franklin as part of the story. So he went to 13-1, and he was getting the programming of 13-3 at that time, is what I think. Correct me on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and Dave, no, it doesn't have to do with the SAP.
you bring up the guide on what you're looking at. You know, you have a guide button on the on these converter boxes, and they're all different. But the one that I have, for instance, tells you what show is on, and it would say, for instance, it would say something to do with a Spanish show, and meanwhile, it's a show that you really want to watch, the normal Channel 13 show, or vice versa, because they've swapped. So that's what it is. And okay, Dick, you have the same kind of problem, so not unusual. And apparently, it happens with different brands. I just think it's an odd thing that does happen. Now, I do have another box. When I checked that one was fine. So it was only this box that flipped. So, what I'll probably do is I'll probably delete it, and I'll probably just rescan it to see what happens. I haven't had a chance to do that. I record these shows. For instance, I want to record the balloon story, and I always check make sure I'm on that channel, and that's what happens. But if you didn't check, you know, the next thing you know, you wouldn't record the show that you thought. And although I have cable vision, I'm not a big fan of. I'm just one of these people that don't want to pay for the DVRs that they have. I like recording it on a disc or even a tape. I don't care, but recording it on a disc and playing it back and having hard copies and things. Somebody's, you know, space reports and things, you really want to keep them. But it don't help if you're on the wrong channel. You think you're on the right channel. Back to you, Dick. WS, come on.
Now, I'm going to double check with you right now, Cole. I am guessing that when you brought up the EPG, Electronic Programming Guide, and you looked at 13-1, 13-2, and 13-3 on the Electronic Programming Guide, it probably told you 13-1 at this time is going to be the balloon story, and 13-2 is the children's programming, and 13-3 is the Spanish program. So I'm guessing the Electronic Programming Guide told you the truth as to what is supposed to be there, but yet when you dialed 13-1, expected the balloon story, there on the screen was the Spanish channel with its video and audio. Is that approximately what happened, Paul? And mine has done that to me. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, QSL, that's right. And maybe all of those, just unplug the whole thing, but and plug it back in and do what you said. Try with, you know, the equivalent of a reboot. Back to you, Dick.
In my case, I'm scared to death to do an electronic scan. One of the things I can select is where it scans all the channels and records the ones that really have a signal and rejects all the others. I have to strongly avoid that because in my particular case where I do television DXing, occasionally I'll get some wild channel that's only there some of the time. And I'll make sure that it's part of my selections, if you know what I mean. And if I did an electronic scan today and if that channel wasn't there, it'll get erased. And I'd like to have the ability to go through the channels that are sometimes there as a way of finding out what propagation is like today. So I don't go back to the electronic scanning. I wish there was a way that you could tell the automatic scan, only write down the new things that you find and don't wipe out the ones that are already there. I'm a little bit afraid that if you do an electronic scan today, it'll only tell you what is coming above threshold today and recording those and wipe everything else out. That's what I think it would do. I wonder if your RCA behaves differently on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, RCA is different. You can save the channels that you have and just add to it. You got to poke around and make sure you do it right, but so you hit one wrong button and they're all gone. I did that with the other box. And then one time I re-scanned it. It was some kind of band opening. I was getting Jersey and all the stations from all over. And I've never seen them again after that. And another thing with the remote control, they have these learning remote controls you can buy now for oh, I don't know, $25 or something, in Walmart even now, they used to have them in Best Buy. And as long as your old remote works, even a little bit, it might be an intermittent thing, but as long as you could point one remote at the other remote and then hit that button, it'll copy what you transmit from the one remote to the other one. And then now you have a brand new remote. You can have as many features, equivalent features that you had with your old remote that doesn't work that good anymore. If the button's shot and you can't transmit anything, then all bets are off. Back to you, Vic.
Now, for a number of years, Radio Shack sold a, I'm going to call it universal remote control. And so whether you had a Zenith, an RCA, an Admiral, whatever brand name of set. And if you knew the model number of the set and you looked it up in their instruction manual and you plugged in that particular number, the whole thing is now substituting for that particular remote control. I'd like to believe that this universal remote control is purchasable today, and in the instruction manual, one of the things it'll tell you is that, this particular dash number will substitute for the remote control for the digital control set-top box of Radio Shack. Do I really have to teach it each individual command? Is there a master control number I can give it for that particular product it's substituting for? What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Comment? I have those remotes, and you'll do a scan, and you'll find out which unit goes to your thing. But sometimes you have a video recorder or maybe something hard like yours where it's not working, and that remote that I have, I forget the name of it, it's some kind of universal remote, I think U4 or something. You do the same thing with all your equipment, maybe four or five pieces of equipment, but then if there's some that aren't working, some button that isn't working, usually common on the on recorders, these DVD recorders, you might have a couple of buttons there. That's where it really comes in handy. But it'll record anything. Back to you.
Very fine, Paul. The person who said comment, please give us your full call and name and give us the benefit of your experience, sir. K2RIW.
This is Kilo 1, Mike Juliet Mike, and the name is Mike. And I recently, within the last few months, I recently bought a $10 universal remote from Walmart. I don't know the name or brand or anything, but it was a package for Walmart kind of thing for $10. It had a list of over 2,400 different model numbers of TV sets and VCRs and other controllers that it was compatible with. You just plug in the, you could go through a sequence of like six or eight keystrokes, and it would know which, you would tell it which controller you wanted it to simulate or emulate, and it would. I bought it for robotic application. I assume it would work for pretty much anything. But that's it. That was my comment. CO1, Mike Juliet, Mike Clear, back over to you, Dick.
That's good information. And by the way, K1MJM, you called yourself Mike. Your real name is Mike Number 2. Because there's a Mike Number 1, Mike Number 2 on these websites that are doing a very nice job of supporting the TechNet. And the guy you just heard is the guy who's got that website, TechNetLimark.com, with some nice information. We're going to be giving you this article from that Eric just brought to our attention from the Bird Company.
You should make that an addendum to your article. That's probably going to be the easiest way for people to find it.
Yeah, they are both on similar subjects, so therefore I guess they should be slightly put together. And so I've got a Walmart store probably less than 8 miles from my house, 5 miles from my house, and this $10 remote or universal remote that you bought, Mike Number 2, how long ago did you buy that? If it was within the last year, no problem. If you bought it 3 years ago, then I hope they still have it as a product. K1MJM, Mike Number 2, K2RIW, go ahead, Mike.
Roger, Vic. I bought it earlier this year. I would say it was earlier in the summer, maybe late in the spring. And I bought it. I had a problem with my truck, and I was down in Virginia, actually. And I had a little robot kit that I was working on, and I wanted to make it a wireless infrared remote control. So I went to Walmart, and I picked this thing up, and it gives you this very lightweight paper. Opens up like a road map. It's huge. The magnifying glass to read it with all the different wireless remotes that it simulates. So yeah, it was probably 6 or 8 months ago, but it was definitely this year. Kilo 1, Mike 2, and Mike number 2.
Well done, Mike number 2. You've helped me a lot tonight because my remote is starting to get a little bit cantankerous. More and more the buttons are failing because it gets so heavy use in my house. There are 3 people in my house that from time to time during each day use that poor thing. It never gets a chance to cool off. Well done. Okay. We've had a good day so far from my point of view. So a little bit off our schedule, but we make sure that we don't rigidly adhere to that schedule. Although last week, as I remember, we hit it exactly at 9 o'clock when we went over to the mailbag. KC2MJN, here we go, KC2WGB. Back to you, John, and are they going to stump us again this week? You got it, John.
Well, first I'm going to ask my question that I filed for.
My goodness, I completely skipped over you. Wow. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, very well, Dick. Last week I ordered a ton of new equipment that came, and in this, these multiple boxes, I have a company called Wavecom that makes directional couplers. There were 6 of them, and they're all variable coupled dB ratings of 60 dB, 30, 20, like that down the line. Very well made. I think I like it better than Narda. Extremely heavy. Okay. On the back, I've never seen this before, there are compensation adjustments for the coupled port. You can compensate for high or low frequency. Is that something that they use to adjust at the factory, although they're not sealed, or is that to be used in the field? Have you ever seen that, and do you know why that's on a coupler? What's it said? I would figure they'd seal it, and it would be the end. Maybe have some information on that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, my experience with Wavecom is they're a good company. They made swept frequency signal generators, sweeping signal generators, among other things. I think they also made a spectrum analyzer. And I guess I've seen some of the directional couplers, but I haven't seen the ones that have extra tuning controls in the back. But I'm going to make some guesses on this one, John. When you read that article about using directional couplers outside of their frequency region, or the portion of the article that I wrote telling you how to get higher directivity, one frequency at a time, so to speak, or maybe even over a small scan set of frequencies, by adding something like a double stub tuner or a double slug tuner after your, or any other kind of a tuning device, minor tuning device, after your directional coupler, you can make its apparent directivity become as high as you like. And as such, what you're really doing, let me drop, is correcting for the fact that the directivity is not ideal. I mean, if your coupler is perfect, in the forward mode, it picks up the signal that it's supposed to out of the directional port. In the reverse mode, for signals flowing the other direction, it should thoroughly reject that signal. But if its directivity is less than ideal, some of the reverse signal leaks through and comes out of that directional port. If, after the directional coupler, you add another device which builds its own reflected signal, and by carefully tuning that device after the directional coupler on the straight through line, you create a second reflection equal in magnitude to the leakage signal, and by careful adjustment, you can make it 180 degrees out of phase. You can cancel the leakage signal that's coming out of the directional port of the directional coupler. So if you can do that with an external double stub tuner, double slug tuner, any kind of a tuning device, if you can do that externally, there's nothing stopping you from doing that internally. So they probably have tuning screws in there. Your next question is going to be, let me drop. Are those tuning screws on the coupled line or on the direct line? It is my guess is they could be on the direct line. To put them on the coupled line, I'm guessing would be a little bit more difficult to make it come out right. Although maybe not. Maybe not. So, but still, I know that by putting tuning devices on the straight through line, you can correct the directivity. So, it sounds to me like it's something that intended to be set at the factory and locked down. And why yours is not locked down is a little bit mysterious. If I was a directional coupler company, I would be quite reluctant to allow the customer to do that tweaking after the product was manufactured, because unless the customer is sufficiently skilled, there's a high probability he could goof it up, and therefore it starts a whole lot of phone conversations of, what do I do now, can you fix it for me? So, if I was Wavecom, I would have locked those down once they're properly set. And maybe somebody forgot to do that, or maybe the one you bought, somebody dissolved the lockdown, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, these screws have not had any seal put on or any paint, and I have six of these, and they're all identical, and none of them are sealed, so I guess what you said is correct. I mean, you can compensate on the coupled port for high and low compensation. So if it's built for the parameters that the factory made it for, I can't see a reason to adjust it. But maybe under certain conditions, you want to tilt it a little bit or cause an error, possibly. I don't know, but thanks for the information, because I've never seen this before. And by the way, this thing is so well made, they've actually have it sealed where you cannot take this apart. It would destroy all the aesthetics. Nice piece of equipment.
Yeah, you said you received six of these Wavecom couplers, and you said some of them are 20, 30, and 60. I think you said one of them is 60 decibels. I've never seen one with that high a attenuation, so to speak, that high, that low coupling coefficient, 60 dB. Yes, you would want to do that in the case of a broadcast transmitter, which is running kilowatts, and you only want milliwatts going into your power sensing device. So is it really 60 dB, or did I mishear that? On top of that, my second question, John, is that you know now, after disassembling some directional couplers, you know the way the strip line internal circuitry usually looks. You know that the straight through line and the strip line inside literally is straight through, usually, from the input connector to the main output connector, and the coupled line is off to one side. From what you know, those tuning screws, do you believe that they are closest to the straight through line, or they're closest to the coupling line? And if they are closest to the coupling line, are they at the output end or the terminated end? What's your best guess on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, if I place this looking from the rear of the coupler at the two screws, the direct line is now in the lower base of the cube, and of course it goes straight through. Now, on the left is the coupled port on the top. The two screws are on the top line, and you know the coupled port comes in as an L. It comes straight down and then goes into an L shape with that ferrite product around it. Those two screws seem to be able to slide up and down to affect that area, not the straight through line.
desired product is usually the 50-ohm terminating resistor. Yes, it looks like a blob of ferrite material, but it is a terminating resistor. Do you believe those screws are closest to the terminating resistor, John?
Yes, I believe as that coupled port line comes down and breaks to the right, it travels under those two screws. Now, those are slotted holes they're in. You loosen the Phillips screw and you can slide it up and down, approximately 3/8 of an inch. And it looks like it's affecting the coupled port line. And the reason I call that a ferrite, if you take the coupler apart and you take the coupled line element out, you can slide that right off of the line. So it, when you have it in your hand, it looks like a piece of ferrite.
Yeah, that is a volumetric resistive material. It looks like ferrite. I think it is not. I think it's a purely resistive material. Next time you've got that in your hand, you can put the two probes of your ohmmeter across it, and you will measure some number of ohms. So if it was ferrite, you put your ohmmeter across it, and I think you would measure an open circuit. But this, I think you're going to measure ohms. It's resistive material. So it sounds to me like that tuning screw is coming near the terminating resistor, and therefore it is allowing you to tweak the terminating resistor. And the more I think about it, I realize now that if you're able to make the terminating resistor go up and down in resistivity or up and down in stray capacitance, in many cases you can do a better job of adjusting directivity. I don't think it's going to give you ability to adjust the coupling coefficient, but I think it will allow you to adjust directivity. So, therefore, you could, at your favorite frequency within the range of that coupler, tune it for a real good notch of directivity, possibly as much as 50 or 55 dB of directivity in the so-called instrumentation class. And once you make a directional coupler that directive, it literally becomes a CW radar. You can do some fancy measurements with that. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, and flip over to the mailbag whenever you want to, K2RIW.
King Bravo 2 Hotel, KB2H.
Stand by, John, KB2H. Start with your name, sir, and your question or comment.
Good evening, Lima Oscar Uniform at King Bravo 2 Hotel. And we just we put up a new antenna here, and we're just trying to make sure the thing gets out. The SWR looks good, and you got sounding good, of course. You know, 99 over whatever. So back to you, caller. I was writing something down there. So go ahead. This is King Bravo 2 Hotel in Northport, New York.
Very fine, Lou. I'm hearing you very nicely on the input. And you may know that that transmitter, each time you transmit, it gives out a tone as if it was the United Kingdom version of a beep that turns on a repeater. So, yeah, that antenna is working well. So, John, back to you. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, both of these screw elements, or sliding elements, are labeled slope compensation. I didn't know if I mentioned that or not. And one is for high frequency, and one is for low frequency. So I will experiment with one of them, probably a coupler that I won't use, but this 60 dB, I'm not going to touch that, and it is 60 dB. I was so surprised I took my jeweler's loop just to make sure there wasn't a decimal in there at like 6 dB or something, but it's 6.0. So, okay, I'll let it drop, and I'll go on to the first question of mailbag. Okay, I have a question from a young ham who's working with some K-attenuator devices. Now, his question is, can they be used in series? And of course, then you would add the attenuation up like resistors, he's assuming. And he'd also like to know if he could use them in parallel so that he could lower the attenuated reading. So if it starts up at 1 and he would have put 2, he would be able to have it at about this. Do you have any adverse feelings about using it that way? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I sure do have some opinions on this one, John. I own some K attenuators, and they usually have sort of a rocker switch, which has numbers like 20, 20, 10, 5, 3, 2, 1. In other words, each one of those rocker switches has a number on it, and as you rock that switch, you get that number of decibels of attenuation. And they usually have something like a BNC connector going in and coming out. And can you put two of those in series, a BNC connector and a male-to-male adapter or a small piece of cable between the two? Absolutely. And do the decibels add up? Absolutely. So if I had two of them cascaded, and K attenuator number one is set on 20, K attenuator number two is set on 30, would I get a total of 50? The answer is yes. Let me drop. There's a little bit of a catch on this one, though. The K attenuator, when you dial in the absolute maximum attenuation, which might be a 65, 71 dB, some number like that, you're getting very close to the point where the leakage around the BNC connectors, your cable, the shielding of the attenuator, is such that if I had two of them cascaded, and if the maximum attenuation I can get out of each one is, let me pick a number, 72 dB, and I cascade two together, mathematically you should get 144 dB of total loss. Don't believe it. When you start exceeding a total loss of, let me pick a number, 80 dB, unless it's very carefully controlled equipment and very well shielded, you can easily hit the situation where the leakage around your step attenuator, the leakage signal, starts becoming equal or stronger than the signal flowing down the center. Very similar to what happens with a Hewlett-Packard signal generator. I could be using my Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. That's an old-fashioned unit that went from 10 megs to 480 megs. And the dial, the maximum attenuation you can get on the dial is, I think, minus 120. And if you're testing a really sensitive receiver, let me drop. You're testing a really sensitive receiver and you want to find out what the ultimate threshold is. Your particular very sensitive receiver in its narrowband mode might go to a minus 135 dBm of signal. And the lowest number you can get out of the dial in the front panel of the signal generator is minus 120. So logically, you would put a 10 or a 20 dB attenuator on the front panel of the signal generator, then connect your cable to that, and now the 120 dB on the dial plus the 20 dB of the attenuator you put externally, you would think the signal is going to go down to minus 140. Well, you run that test. Unless your receiver is extremely well shielded, you'll suddenly discover that the leakage from the cabinet of the signal generator is stronger than the signal that you're sending down the center of that center conductor coming out of the signal generator, going through your 20 dB pad, going to your cable, into the receiver on the test. The leakage signal out of the cabinet becomes stronger. There is a way of getting around this. Let me drop. It's called the New England technique. Apparently the guys in New England discovered this one day, that yes, the real oscillator inside of your signal generator is probably running at plus 50 milliwatts or something like that, you know, plus 17 dBm. And so you're asking for 140 dB of shielding of the cabinet when you do that test. You can't get that amount of shielding. So the signal radiated by the cabinet starts dominating into your very sensitive receiver. However, if you're smart enough to put the signal generator in the backyard and the receiver inside the house, or vice versa, you separate the two by, let me pick a number, 20 dB, and you get a long piece of coax, 20 feet. You separate them by 20 feet, so that even though the cabinet is leaking, the signal coming out of the leakage of the cabinet is going through the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and the signal generator, the leakage signal is going down by 6 dB. So set enough distance between that signal generator with a long cable into your receiver on the test, and you can get around that problem. And now you can measure a minus 140 dBm sensitivity of your receiver. So except for that phenomenon, you can definitely cascade K attenuators. Let me drop them. Now, if you study what each one of those steps of the K attenuator is doing, if you get the owner's manual and you look at the schematic diagram, or you open up the cabinet and you look in, you open up the box and you look inside, you'll find out that each one of those attenuators, in the bypass mode, is a straight through piece of wire. That makes sense. In the attenuate mode, it is a pi attenuator. There is a shunt resistor from input to ground, a series resistor, and a second shunt resistor between output and ground. So each one of those steps goes into a pi layout arrangement of three resistors for each one of those steps. Therefore, the reason they do that is to make sure that when you set each one of those attenuation modes, that the input impedance of the whole step attenuator and the input impedance of each individual stage inside of the step attenuator, the 20 dB stage, the 10 dB stage, the 6 dB stage, and so on, you want to make sure that each one of those stages presents 50 ohm input impedance, 50 ohm output impedance, simultaneous to giving you the attenuation you've selected. Let me drop. So now the whole K attenuator and each one of its internal stages are matched to 50 ohms at each step along the line. Therefore, if by external BNC T connectors or whatever, you now put the two K attenuators in parallel, you've now taken a pair of 50 ohm impedance devices, and at a low enough frequency where the wavelength between the two is not critical, you have now put a pair of 50 ohm devices in parallel, therefore you've created a 25 ohm device. That ain't good, because you're starting off with a 50 ohm signal generator, you got a piece of cable coming out of it that's 50 ohm impedance, going into this arrangement of K attenuators. In series, that's not a problem. You put them in parallel, and now the input impedance of the pair in parallel will be 25 ohms. The output impedance of the two in parallel will be 25 ohms. And so, yes, you can dial in various amounts of attenuation. And by the way, the attenuation, if it's not equal on each K attenuator, the result is going to be spooky. If you dial one of them for 20 and one of them for 30 dB, you think you're going to get somewhere between 20 and 30, or the geometric mean between those divided by 2? Not necessarily. But you've created another problem. Your receiver under test is now going to be looking into a 25 ohm arrangement of K attenuators. That's not good. Your signal generator is going to be looking into a 25 ohm arrangement of K attenuators. That's not good. Therefore, the lengths of cables on both ends is going to be doing impedance inverting. And so, what impedance will the receiver see? If you happen to have a quarter wavelength of cable from the output into the receiver under test, the 25 ohms will become 100 ohms. So the receiver will see 100 ohms. Maybe the signal generator is going to see 25. And under those conditions, do you think you can really...
Repeater, time out.
Now you're going to be asking the question, under those conditions, can you get a calibrated amount of attenuation under the proper impedance? And the answer is no and no. The number of decibels you're going to get is going to be spooky, calculatable, but spooky, and the impedances you're going to get are going to be spooky. So I fairly strongly recommend that you do not put them in parallel. It's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to blow up. Do it as an experiment if you want, but it's not going to be a test procedure that will be accepted by the Bureau of Standards, if you know what I mean. You've got a very unusual test procedure. Now, if you wanted to make sure that your receiver works correctly when it sees 25 ohms impedance instead of 50, yeah, it's a good test to do. But it's not a calibrated test. So parallels are no-no. Series, yes, as long as you don't go to super high numbers. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second hand.
Very good. Okay, now he's got a good idea what he can do there. So in series is a go. Parallel could be, like I said, spooky. And I want to let him know that KW does make attenuators that start at point one and go all the way up to 10 or 20 dB. So if he's looking to lower, he can get them on eBay pretty reasonable. Those are, they make some nice stuff. All right, I'm going to drop them. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, have an amateur here who's asking the question, what is the purpose of the two-tone test that he hears about? He can't find anything that he understands to read. He has no test equipment. He's just getting started, so maybe you could give him a quick rundown on what that's about, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, the two-tone test has, over the last 40 years, become the gold standard for measuring linearity of a radio circuit. And it could also be done in audio, but it certainly was first invented for testing the linearity of a single sideband amplifier. Because if your single sideband amplifier is not amplifying that very complicated signal called single sideband, a single sideband signal, when you see it displayed on a ordinary oscilloscope where voltage is vertical and time is horizontal, it's a fairly complicated looking signal. It bears a relationship to your voice that's going into the microphone, but to properly amplify that without clipping off the tops or creating crossover distortion, and by the way, either one of those non-linearities, upper and lower clipping or crossover distortion, will make the voice received by the guy at the other end not sound clean. Also, it will create splatter. In other words, if you've got a pretty powerful transmitter at a field day site, and there's another field day site a mile away, and they're tuned 20 KC away and trying to get operation, and you've got this non-linear transmitter with intermodulation distortion, the word splatter means that although you're filling up your particular channel, let's say 3 kilohertz wide with your single sideband signal, you'll be creating other signals 6, 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 KC away that are going to be jamming the poor guy in the next field day site a mile away, and he's going to eventually become very unhappy with your operation. Let me drop. Now, I'm going to try to explain to you why a two-tone test is so valuable. And in the older versions of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, there was a section on single sideband explaining quite a bit of the two-tone test. I don't know if the full explanation has remained in the latest version, the latest edition of the Radio Amateur's Handbook. There also was some, when single sideband was first being introduced, way back in the 1955 time frame, when it started to really become popular, there were a lot of manuals written at that time that went into the nitty gritty of explaining why it exists. I'm going to try to do that for you now. Let me drop. Let's assume now that I'm doing a test of a 50 megacycle single sideband transmitter, and I've got two separate signal generators. One set at 50.0 megahertz, one set at 50 megahertz plus 10 kilohertz. So I've got two signal generators that are very ideal, variable in output frequency, variable in output signal strength, but I've set them exactly 10 kilohertz apart in my example. And as long as I'm combining them with the right kind of a network, now I've got a hybrid combining device, and the hybrid combining device, to really do the test correctly, has to have a whole lot of isolation. So you know what a power divider looks like. It's a device where your input connector, we'll call it connector number one, you put a signal into it, and out of connector number two and connector number three comes half power out of two, half power out of three, exactly equal in amplitude, exactly equal in phase are the two outputs. That's a power divider network. And in theory, if you feed that backwards with two signal generators, I put signal generator number one into connector number two, signal generator number 2 into connector number 3, and out of the common port, connector number 1, out of that power summer, power divider, used backwards as a summer, I've now got those two signals. I can look at them on a spectrum analyzer, and I'll see 50.0 and 50.01 in my example, 10 kc higher. However, you want to make sure that that power divider slash power summer has very high isolation. By that I mean, you have to make double darn sure that none of the signal out of signal generator number 1 going into the power summer has a sneak path by which it gets into signal generator number 2 and vice versa. Any of the signal coming out of signal generator number 2, you want to make sure that none of it gets into signal generator number 1, because when you shove a signal back into a signal generator, there is a certain probability that the signal generator will do some funny things when another signal is coming back into its output port. So there's got to be very high isolation in that power summing device. Okay. Once you've got that criteria met, and now you look at the output of the common port of the power summer, the two signals are there. You've carefully adjusted them to be exactly equal in amplitude. Okay? And just for an example now, I'm going to reset signal generator number 1. In my real test for my amplifier in the test, I might put those two signal generators 10 kilohertz apart. But for this explanation now, I'm going to make these two signal generators, they're both frequency synthesized, they're both connected to the exact same reference oscillator. So therefore, if I had the ability to dial signal generator number 1 at exactly 50 megahertz, and exactly signal generator number 2, I dialed at exactly 50 megahertz plus 1 hertz. Signal generator number 2 is 1 cycle per second, 1 hertz higher in frequency than signal generator number 1. There's a reason why I've chosen that, just to give you an explanation. Let me show you. I'm now looking at the output on my oscilloscope of the common port of the power summer. Because the two signal generators are so close in power, so close in frequency, that's also true. On my oscilloscope, I'm really going to see one single sine wave at what looks like 50 megahertz. Even though I've got two signal generators and they're 1 hertz apart, no normal oscilloscope, no normal spectrum analyzer can resolve two signals that are only 1 hertz apart. They will look like one composite signal. Okay? You now know that because there's 1 hertz of difference, that for 1/2 a second, those two signals are going to be in phase with each other, and for 1/2 a second beyond that, they're going to be out of phase with each other. So they're very slowly sliding in phase and out of phase because they're very slightly different in frequency. Let me also use as a silly example, let's assume that the output from signal generator number 1 coming out of the power summing device, let me assume it was 1 millivolt from signal generator number 1. If I turn on only signal generator number 1, I see a 1 millivolt signal. I turn off signal generator number 1, turn on signal generator number 2, I see 1 millivolt signal. Now I turn on both signals simultaneously, and I watch what happens on my oscilloscope. During the time that they're in phase, I will, for a short period of time, see a signal of 2 millivolts. This network obeys superposition. Superposition means that if I put in the first signal and measure the voltage response, then put on the second signal all by itself, measure the voltage response, then plug in both signals simultaneously, I add the voltages of the repeater.
Time out.
If my network obeys superposition, and a simple resistor summing device should do that, it'll obey superposition. Now when I turn on both, I sum the two voltages. For a period of time when they're in phase, I will see 2 millivolts at a 50 megahertz rate. During the time they're out of phase, I will see that 2 millivolts go all the way down to 0 volts. when they're exactly out of phase for a brief period of time, it will go to zero. If I now ran the oscilloscope horizontal sweep real slow, and if it's a storage type oscilloscope, I will see a pattern on the oscilloscope that looks like a butterfly pattern. I will see two millivolts of peak in one area, 0 volts of null, and the whole process will repeat a couple of times on that screen. They call it a butterfly pattern. I'm trying to think of other ways of describing it. It looks like the output envelope looks like a rectified sine wave, but inside it's all filled up with 50 hertz of sine wave inside of each one of those envelopes. Okay? Now, if you study what's happening, if you had the ability to take millimeter. If I took each horizontal millimeter of what's displayed on that oscilloscope, and I converted the amplitude in volts into decibels, and there's ways you can do that. My average signal is going to be something like 1 millivolt. And let's convert now to, I was talking about millivolts, but now I'm going to convert it to milliwatts. Assume it was 1 milliwatt. 1 milliwatt is called 0 dBm, 0 dB with reference to a milliwatt. So my average signal is 0 dBm. During the time that I'm getting 2 milliwatts, that is plus 3 dBm. So it's got a peak amplitude of plus 3 dBm. During the time the signal goes to zero, one of those notches, if I convert that to decibels, a 0 dB signal, a 0 milliwatt signal, is in decibels minus infinity in decibels. As you can tell, in decibels, you're getting a huge transition. Anything that goes near zero starts becoming great big negative decibel numbers real fast. The bottom line of this is that when you put that composite signal into your amplifier and the test, even though you've only adjusted two separate signal generators for a pure sine wave of output, each one of them is thoroughly unmodulated, but by the way you're combining the two, you're testing the thorough dynamic range of your amplifier under test. At the peak, when the two signals are in phase, let me drop. You could adjust the amplitude in such a way that at the peak, when the two signals are in phase, it's at the maximum power output your amplifier is capable of creating. During the time that the two signals go out of phase and they go into a notch, it's the absolute minimum signal that your signal to generator can, your amplifier can tolerate. No signal at all. In some conditions, an amplifier will go into a crossover distortion, will start creating some noise. It can do all kinds of funny things when the signal goes to zero. So you're going at each cycle of the butterfly. Now, if I go back to the original test where I'm setting the two signal generators 10 kilohertz apart, 10 kilohertz is, let me put that into numbers, that's 100 microseconds. Each butterfly is now 100 microseconds apart. Every 100 microseconds, because my two signal generators are 10 kilohertz apart, every 100 microseconds, my amplifier under test is getting a full blast signal all the way down to zero amplitude signal, and you're repeating that cycle of performance. You're measuring the complete dynamic range of your amplifier 10,000 times per second. You're going through that complete amplitude range of your amplifier under test by simply adjusting those two signals. Now, if your amplifier is really linear, if it doesn't have any flap top distortion, if it doesn't have any crossover distortion during the time the signals go to zero, if it doesn't create any bursts of noise anywhere along that dynamic range, then when you've got a real good spectrum analyzer looking at the output of the signal going into the amplifier to test, first of all, you're going to see nothing on the screen except two pure tones. Let me drop. On a good spectrum analyzer, you'll see one vertical line representing 50 megahertz, 10 kilohertz over to the right of that, you'll see a second vertical line representing the 50 megahertz plus 10 kilohertz. you'll see two signals on the screen, two vertical lines, and nothing else. That composite signal now goes into your amplifier to test, and if your amplifier is 100% linear, what comes out is the exact same two lines, except now they're a hell of a lot stronger. You may be putting in milliwatts, and if your amplifier is capable of 100 watts of peak power output, you're going to see those two lines coming out, where each one of those lines will be at 25 watts. You may ask the question, how come they're not at 50 watts? Well, when you're doing a two-tone test, and if your amplifier has a peak power capability of 100 watts, and because each of the individual tones are being added together in a voltage manner, therefore each of those tones must be at half the voltage of what your amplifier can tolerate. Half voltage is 6 dB down. 6 dB down is 1/4 power. So if you're doing the test of an amplifier that has a peak envelope power capability of 100 watts, let me drop. Your amplifier's got the peak power output capability of 100 watts, but you're going to adjust this test such that each individual tone, one at a time, going to your amplifier, is creating 25 watts of output, 1/4 power. You take a pair of 25 watt signals that are slightly different in frequency, and you sum them together. That's what your amplifier is doing, so to speak. A pair of 25 watt signals will periodically hit 0 watts when they're out of phase, and will hit 100 watts when they're in phase. A 4-to-1 ratio of power of each individual signal versus the peak envelope power of the sum of the two. If your amplifier is thoroughly linear, you'll see two pure tones of exactly 25 watts coming out. As you start getting any kind of nonlinearity, flat topping, crossover distortion, phase shift, noise bursts, Barkhausen oscillations, whatever, if there's any kind of nonlinearity on that amplifier, on this very severe test, let me drop. And your spectrum analyzer will light up like a Christmas tree. You'll start seeing a whole lot of other signals. Your two signals of interest are exactly 10 kilohertz apart in my first example, the example we're talking about right now. If there's third order intermodulation distortion, you'll start seeing a second pair of signals that are 10 kilohertz above the high one and 10 kilohertz below the low one. They'll be separated by, I think it's 30 kilohertz, like 10, 20, they'll be separated by 30 kilohertz, I think it is. So, whatever is the separation between the two signals, you'll start seeing other signals with that exact same separation. So, the two signals that are 10 kilohertz, one is 10 kilohertz higher than the highest, one's 10 kilohertz lower than the lowest, those are called third order intermodulation distortion. You'll probably also see some other signals that are 20 kilohertz higher and 20 kilohertz lower. Those are called fifth order intermodulation distortion. So by measuring the exact magnitude of those other undesired products, you now have a mathematical process by which you can describe the exact amount of nonlinearity of your amplifier. The exact amount of nonlinearity, you would think by common sense, you can test that by, let me drop. You would think you could test the linearity of your amplifier by first putting in 1 milliwatt, then putting in one single tone of 1 milliwatt, then 0.5 milliwatt, then 0.25 milliwatt, then 0.8 milliwatt. You put in all those individual amplitudes of one single tone and measure the power output. You would think you would be measuring linearity if you do that. Yes, you are. But there's a catch. Each one of those outputs at different power levels coming out now depends on perfect linearity and perfect accuracy of your power meter that's measuring the power output power. And also your instrumentation that's producing the input power. You've now got a double problem of accuracy of, you think you're doing 2-to-1 steps of amplitude going in, and you might have some error to that, and you think you're going to see 2-to-1 steps of the output power, and now the linearity and accuracy of your power output meter will be in question. You think you're measuring linearity. Yes, to a degree you are, but a hell of a lot of what you're measuring is really the accuracy of your instrumentation going through the input power and your instrumentation measuring the output power. It's a very difficult test, and it's hard to interpret. Let me drop.